Pennsylvania. This B?
The Seneca Nation, he was born in New York and came down to New Jersey about 15 years ago. He had many important assignments of one kind or another. I believe she might have started out in the early years as a reporter of the Saha Medical Indian Newspaper, National Indian Newspaper, and on the board of a number of organizations, one of which I'll mention, the American Indian History Society, in this meeting.
I'm very pleased that Mr. Stevens can be with us tonight and take out time from his very busy schedule. This is the end of the first year of work for the American Indian Policy Review Commission. Those of you who have received Indian Truth know that Mr. Stevens had his own business, was president of American Indian Consultants, the firm he owned. Then he is a past vice president of the National Congress of American Indians and was director of community services and director of economic development for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You may also know, if you have received Indian Truth and read it, that the American Indian Policy Review Commission is the first comprehensive review of the national Indian situation in something like 47 years. Since the Marion Report of 1928. These are important facts for you to know, but more than that, I'd like you to know that Mr. Stevens is an Oneida Indian from Wisconsin. I'm a Seneca from New York State. The Oneidas and the Senecas are part of the League of the Iroquois. An important fact for you to know in this bicentennial year is that the Oneidas fought on the side of the colonists during the American Revolution. And the fragmentation of the League of the Iroquois that followed the American Revolution, the rights of the tribes were not properly upheld, and there was no good action on part of the League of the Iroquois directly following the Revolutionary War to get proper recognition of their rights and land rights in New York State. Eventually, there was such deterioration of land base through various devices, not all of them very honest. There was a great deal of pressure on the tribes in New York State from land agencies. Eventually, the Oneidas left New York State and went to Wisconsin, where again they were subject to great land losses. I said to Mr. Stevens, it's a wonder there are any of you guys left, but I'm awfully glad there are, that Mr. Stevens is here tonight. Mr. Ernest Stevens.
Thank you, Betty. Thank you, friends. I came to talk about the very important legislation that I'm involved in. First of all, I guess I'd like to just talk about some things to kind of give you an idea about the kind of person you're dealing with, the kind of people I associate with. I suppose in a lot of ways, as Betty says, it's altogether fitting and proper that an Oneida person should play some kind of a role in this sense. I don't know exactly the details and the fateful kinds of decisions that were forced on my ancestors or whatever they might have voluntarily taken upon themselves. But I knew that it cost us everything, including even our relationships with our own brothers and sisters. And on a high note, I'd say that after 200 years, the prospects of the prophecies related to the League of the Iroquois have never been right. And I would never have known, when I was a little boy, to, you have to picture our situation. We had moved to Wisconsin. And I guess what we originally thought was going to be an Iroquois empire in the West, which our empire was rapidly reduced by a succeeding treaty and a succeeding treaty, and then finished off with the, what we heard about, the Allotment Act and the Oneida tribe's final land base of what was once 8 million acres reduced down to 500,000 acres and down to 65,400 acres and now reduced down to approximately 3,000 acres, all of which we've acquired since 1934, incidentally. It was down to, I guess at one point, like about 38 acres or something like that. And so, a people who paid some little stake in me, you know, the birth of this country, I think, in more ways than one. And I think we have to, we can, we're doing some research, and I was trying to get some more accurate research and specific kinds of remarks made by the founding fathers related to the League of the Iroquois. And the researchers have been having little problems with it. And I said, what seems to be the problem? It's, well, we can't find enough specific reference to the Constitution and the founding of the United States being based on the League of the Iroquois, which is really no surprise to me. But I said, well, why don't you try checking out Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, you know, for Oakers, so we're able to find some things. So, you know, I couldn't really explain it, but I know in my life and some of the very thing, the many things I've been active in about the last 12 years, there's some very strange things kind of happen when I feel like the possibly providence itself is involved. And I think, and I know, I think I know that the future of the Indian people is assured. And one wouldn't think so with some of the awful kinds of trials that we have to go to, or at least some, a good many of our people have to go through even now. But there's something happening, and it seems to be good, and it seems to be having to do with the, I think, the Indian people themselves. And like anything else that begins to go, you know, some people complain about, you know, depending on Indian or non-Indian, complaining about the style in which some of our people operate. When you come to a certain position, I guess you come naturally to those kinds of styles. I'm an alcoholic, and a slightly arrested case of only 3 years, so I don't really brag about it yet. But, so it has been my own experience with the kinds of people that I have associated in my lifetime. And many people think because of the kinds of positions that I've had in the Indian world, that, particularly the institutional kinds of positions I've held, that I have some kinds of fancy credentials, and the fact of the matter is I have very little education. And I don't believe that I'm not educated. I think I'm very well educated. At least formally, I don't have it. Just didn't get around to it once I got moving. Previous to 1963, I was almost a practicing and working full-time alcoholic. And didn't leave any time for anything, even work. I was just out to the inauguration of a good friend of mine who, you know, there's a curious kinds of people coming into the Indian world right now with curious kinds of mixes. You can't really count on anybody's particular background. Isn't a certain kind of activist, a certain kind of militant? There are some funny mixes of people. And a friend of mine just won the election out in the Ogallala Sioux tribe, who is many interesting kinds of things, and a reservation that is incredibly blood conscious. He is a mixed blood who was supported by full bloods. He is a former BIA superintendent. Got pulled off the reservation by the Commission on Indian Affairs. Came back to win the tribal presidency by a very large landslide. And I am hoping that some of his intentions and some of the healing powers, I think that he can institutionalize, take place in that preservation. And I, for one, have never been blood conscious, because I guess the Six Nations people, we really can't talk about pure bloodlines, because I think most anybody knows about the history of our people and knows how we know how. I guess we're about the last ones to be biological purists. We can be a mighty people on the basis of the kinds of ways that we operated and the kinds of things that we believed in. And I think that one of the things that I told Senator Averick, just the other day, was that what was wrong, with tribal government was probably wrong with America. And at least if they are relating back to the Six Nations system of government, wherein everybody was accountable, all leadership was accountable directly to people. And where the mightiest chief could be removed, I asked the woman. Could be removed by a woman. So it's very interesting. Coming around with a new concept called women's lib. Like democracy itself is no new concept to us. I don't talk back to my grandmother. So, Senator Averick, yes. Somebody in the president's office, yes. Secretary of the Interior, yes. I'm not my grandmother. Just isn't permitted. Anyway, a lot of interesting things are happening, and I just wanted to start off by just talking about the kinds of things, and I think you can feel how I feel. And there's a lot of things you don't have to say. I think you know what I'm talking about. I think great things are going to happen, but like I did a curious thing. I embraced the Native American church, and that is highly unusual for someone who all belongs to my tribe. The reason for it is because it did me a bit of good when it seemed like there wasn't anything else I could do to take care of some of my personal problems. I happen to know some friends who were involved in that particular church. Whatever it is that they got, it worked for me. So, my children are Longhouse members, and I'm very proud of them, and I consider them to be super Indians. So, as a preface, I wanted you all to know that this is probably most important piece of legislation, which is much understated because of some controversy that's involved. Have to understand that if anybody on God's earth, anybody in America, Indian or white man, senator or whatever, I hope that without regard to any other members of our commission, standing before you as a person that's going to see to it that this report has impact. And I'm hoping that the rest of the Indians and some of the non-Indians and friends of Indians that are involved with this particular thing have the same kind of feeling about it, because I do. And was nothing unusual with me. I've been by design, some kind of an institutional rebel for about 12 years. I always laugh and say that I have the finest apple record of any Indian in America. Everybody's into the, not everybody, a good deal, many people are somehow at least implicitly vying for some sort of leadership type of role that it really clears things up if you can throw down your credentials as being an outstanding sellout from the outset. And then people don't expect too much from you. The leaders don't feel threatened. And I don't exactly really mean that, and I don't mean to criticize myself, but that's how I sometimes describe myself, because it's been my experience that many Indians spend a good part of their time accusing each other of being sellouts. If you can concede the point in the first place, you have less to argue about. And then when you can rise above above yourself and do something and strike a blow for Indians, it's all gravy. And I've been very lucky in the kinds of things I've been in. I've been in the pit of Indian activity since I got involved with Indian affairs, right from the outset. Worked in the city of Los Angeles, state of Arizona, California. I was an intertribal director in California. That's some measure of an institutional position. I've been a tribal planner. And, of course, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, so Director of Human Services and Economic Development. And whenever anything has been happening, either me or my sons have been there. I had to throw in my sons because of the takeovers I missed. Because of my institutional responsibilities, my sons had to make some trips out west, in which they were members of the occupying forces. And in any case, last year, just as a matter of fact, 2 days before I was going to leave town, a bill that I know the National Congress of American Indians was very anxious to see get passed, and many other people who thought it was kind of a far-out type of thing. It was a bill proposed which they would take six congressmen and senators, five Indians, and put together a joint congressional commission to examine Indian affairs using predominantly an Indian task force to do the work in nine subject areas. And seems like it all started out rather smoothly until, you know, I guess one might have guessed, you know, those five Indians, that was the key. We started out with 999,000 angry Indians and disgruntled candidates. I don't exactly mean that, and I respect many opinions, but you can see how difficult it is to span all the tribes, the interests, the regional groups, I would have to say, and all due respect to Western tribes, that there was kind of a classic omission. I am not saying anything. I have come to really count on the Indian commissioners. And I guess more so than the six white men that I work for. And powerful as they are, I have more faith in the Indians, if for no other reason than they're Indians. And in any case, there was a classic omission of a Western landed tribe. I don't believe that there was an omission of the interests and the kinds of... I don't know that anybody could be more conscious of what it means to lose your land than some of the rest of us. I don't think there were... I don't see anybody that could be more conscious of losing land or getting terminated than Ada Deer and myself. I don't think anybody could possibly feel that any harder than some of the nationally involved Indians. In any case, that lasted quite a while, and I think it's important to tell you who these people are. And the chairman of the... Oh, and incidentally, I don't know if I told you, it's 93580. It's the American Indian Policy Review Commission Act. And it is a joint congressional commission. I emphasize that now because sometimes when us Indians get involved with things, they always think it's some new Indian outfit or something. And the fact of the matter is we're trying to add a little dignity by pointing out to people who are congressional commission. It's the first commission in the history of the nation that was jointly senators, congressmen, and citizens. The first commission of this type for any purpose. And the chairman and the vice chairman, I think that's, I have to underline them for some particular reasons. The chairman of the commission is Senator James Abers from South Dakota, who is also coincidentally the chairman of the Indian Subcommittee of the Senate. The vice chairman is Congressman Lloyd Meads, who is also coincidentally the chairman of the Indian Subcommittee of the House. Those two notes, anybody who is wondering whether or not the two main bosses of this commission will do anything about their own report, you know, answer it for yourself. It seems to me that I always use that as a prime example, so what makes this any different than any other? What makes this different is that the two men in charge of putting the report together are also the people who are charged with doing something about it. And I suspect they will. I have no doubt that there will be major legislation. I have no doubt that there will be major changes. And many of us who are working on the commission thinking, well, we've been delayed from some of our other activities for the next 2 years. We're going to spend a couple more seeing to it that a good part of the recommendations which come forth are acted on. And that is my intent, no matter where I live. And in any case, the other senators, say your Senator Metcalf from Montana, is the other majority member. The minority member is Senator Hatfield, Mark Hatfield from Oregon, who is the minority member. In the House, the minority member is Congressman Sam Steiger from Arizona, and the majority member is Congressman Sid Yates from Chicago, who is, coincidentally, the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee, the Indian Appropriations Subcommittee of the House, another very key person. And he is already changed a good deal of his thinking in relation to how things are being handled. And I'll talk to you more about, hopefully more about the budget later if you can. But the distribution of the federal budget would be kind of a key thing as far as I'm concerned, to give an example of the Bureau of Indian Affairs travel. Exactly, I suspect there's a little more to it than that, but their travel budget for the last few years is $12 million. What do you mean, that last 3 years? Assuming Indian Health Service is pretty good size, and the other departments of the government deal with Indians is pretty good size, and the Indian funding is pretty good size. I have an idea that somewhere between $75 and $100 million travel figures will come down in that area. And even if that mythical 1 4/10 billion budget, I say mythical because we pretty well smashed the myth already in our budget, we have determined something less than a billion. But even at 1 4/10 billion, $75 to $100 million worth of travel is a whole lot of traveling around. So we're doing a whole budget, and there's a lot more to it than that. Looking at the cost of administration. And as a point of information, direct services to Indians. Direct services to Indians for, it took me 4 hours to explain this to my budget people. If you are not budget people, I think you'll understand immediately that direct services to Indians, bureaucrats never understand this. I've been a bureaucrat. Somehow you're thinking it's, but direct services to Indians is money that goes directly to Indians or is given to Indians for the purposes of using it to hire the people we want to. That's direct services to Indians. All else then is administration. In 1851, you know, which times were not all that good, the Bureau was just getting started. ratio of direct services to administration was 80% direct services to Indians, 20% administration. In 1951, direct services to Indians was 0.25%, administration was 99.75%. I don't care what any bureaucrat tells you. True. They were telling Congress and Congress and other people that they were spending anywhere from 4 to 10% administration when I was in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. As a parting shot, one of the real advantages in fussing around with the establishment is you can lay down the word and then they got to prove you're wrong. So I just grabbed the figure out of the air and I said, and when I was an NCI officer, I said that 90%. And I knew this absolutely because I was an assistant commissioner, associate commissioner. 90% of the Bureau's money was tied up in administration. Frank Sarb, who then was working Office of Management Budget, asked the Bureau of Indian Affairs to answer that. And they said, that is not true. It's only 78%. So we had a figure to latch on. So we're interested in those types of things. The report or the investigations of the commission are partly decided on by the very nature of the legislation in two very important regards. One of them is that it's task force constituted. By that, I mean there are 9 task forces, 9 subject areas. There are, by law, required 3 members each. The three members were elected, and it took us actually 2 months to elect them all. We had some runoffs, things like that. And nobody has the perfect team, but such as it is, and by the election, I believe we have some fine people on our task forces, very credible people. I'd like to say, you know, I don't usually like to point out that somebody almost made it, but Betty Mealy came in fourth. I cheered for her. As it turns out, I have every reason to wish that she had come in second. Our task force is not one of the stronger ones that we have. They have fine people on here, but I don't think they have the kind of savvy that Betty has. So the budgetary, the limitation is $2.5 million for 2.5 years. And that sounds like a lot of money until you talk about that BIA travel budget. So when they tell me, you know, I always get teased by some of my former associates, and that's what I always throw. So what do you do with all your money? I said, you mean like your travel money? So it's a short period of time, especially since the formation of the commission created a lot of controversy from a lot of different quarters. It's kind of disheartening for a while there until you get the idea that it's to be expected in many ways. And one of the things that I find as an Indian that's very disheartening is that we are only now, I think, as a matter of fact, the last few years, beginning to have any faith in ourselves or each other. So we're still into saying, I find Indian criticism and Indian things to be a form of self-hate. I thought about it a great deal. It means, well, something like, I know I'm a bum, and since I'm a better person than the other Indian, I know he's a bum too. Well, whenever you hear an Indian attack on another Indian, just mark yourself down a bum. But I'm serious about it, and it's really disheartening because I think right now at this point in time, we have to have faith in ourselves and we have to have faith in each other. And anybody that is a traditional or aspires to be a traditional, I'm sure they know. know that that's a very cornerstone of our spirituality, is respect for ourselves and each other. And I guess if I wanted to be anything else someday, it would be a real ending. And I guess the best you can do is try. So, but I know that's one thing. And then I'm still a very aggressive person, but I have a whole lot of more respect for my own people the last few years when I finally got the handle on that. And they perform better too. And you expect good things from them and you know they're capable of it. The task forces that were picked, I have reports which will be due on July 21st, and the first three, I'll name them second. July 21st, August 4th, and August 17th. Now, what we have done, and I am still crossing my fingers, is we have made a commitment to publish the task force reports independently and prior to the commission report, which is due next January 20th, 1977. And the purpose, the purposes are probably two main ones. One is that we have fought, and by we, I think we're talking about our staff mostly initially, because they had the most to say about things when we first got started. And the other member of the staff is Kirk Kickingbird, who is a Kiowa. He's our general counsel. And Max Richmond is from the Lost Tribes. I don't know if you know what that is. Congressman Yates. And in any case, he handles our administration. And Kirk and Max are both attorneys. So we have, they double as both the legal counsel and the and what we determined we wanted to do is we wanted to protect the integrity and the independence of our task forces. And I'd like to tell you who some of the task force people are, because they have integrity to protect. And you may not universally vote on all of these people and say they're 100%, but I think all of you will notice the names of some of the people. The chairman of the first task force, called Trust Responsibilities and Federal-Indian Relationships, including Treaty Review, is Hank Adams. And Hank Adams, in my mind's eye, is not only a very credible person, a very positive activist, but in my mind's eye, I have all the more reason to know that now. I've seen more and more of his writings. One of the real Indian intellects of the United States. And I certainly hope that there's been so many Indian books, but I hope you save a spot for Hanks. I hope he writes one soon, because he's an impressive intellect and a real doer. He's the chairman. The other two members are John Echohawk, who is a Pawnee and an attorney from Oklahoma who heads up the Native American Rights Fund. Doug Nash, a Nez Perce, who is an attorney in private practice, including he is the tribal attorney for his own tribe, which is a new thing that we're coming up with now. The task force number two is tribal government. Wilbur Etcity is the chairman. He's the executive assistant to Peter McDonald, or at least he was the last I heard. And Alan Parker is a Chippewa Cree. I'd like to throw in there that he can't escape the fact that he's a quarter of a night or two. Jerry Flute is the chairman of the Assistant Lofton. They are the ones who are dealing with tribal government. Federal administration and structure of Indian affairs is absolutely key. I think that is one of the more prestigious task forces, and the one in a lot of ways is causing me a whole lot of problems. And that's the way it is with people who who think independently and are strong. They always cause problems, but they always put up fine work too. And the chairman is Sam Deloria, and he is a head of the American Indian Law Center in Albuquerque. And I won't say he's the brother of Brian Deloria because he doesn't like that. Greg Getty is the treasurer of the National Congress of American Indians, and last but not least, and I say this because there are call both among us, Mel Tenasca, who is the president of the National Congress of American Indians, and who was, we were running mates a few years ago in Tulsa, and we are very close friends. Mel is a doer, and Mel is a real Indian all the way. Those three will handle the very important business of recommending what's going to be done in federal administration of Indian affairs. I might say part of their investigation has just been launched, and that is the inevitable review of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I say inevitable because no commission can be complete without one. Right? And so one of the things that they've done, and I don't know if it's ever been done before, but it probably hasn't, since it makes a whole lot of just fundamental sense. And that is, we have taken all the reports on the Bureau of Indian Affairs and put them together. And, you know, examine them as part of the opening shot. And as far as I know, that hasn't been done. So then the other thing that we did was we picked a mixture of public, private people, including the General Accounting Office, members of our own staff, and members of private industry, and they have just started looking at this. And I don't really think all that much about management studies, but we may come up with something. That particular task force, I think I could tell you, they're about to report it out 2 weeks from now. Task Force 1, Task Force 3 are coming out with a recommendation, at least as an alternative and independently of each other, of a separate agency for Indian affairs, out of Interior, out of Justice Department, and they will probably have different presentations. As far as I know, of the 11 task forces and special reports, there are at least 5 coming down with some form of an independent agency recommendation. I want to bring that up because as Indians and supporters of Indians and friends of Indians, we're going to count on you a whole lot. I am a personal supporter of that and helped draft a position like that at the National Convention a couple of years ago. And there's been enough said, I don't think my boss would object if I said that the Bureau of Indian Affairs just has got to be separated from the Interior and Justice Department. I recommended we have an Indian desk in the Bureau. I was only kidding. We have an increasing number of Indians in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and I guess that is good news. But the institutional kind of problems that they have will never be circumvented until they're independent. There are a lot of fine Indian people coming in here now, but that agency is never going to be anything until it's controlled by Indians and independent of everybody else. The next one is federal, state, and tribal jurisdiction. And that's Sherwin Broadhead. He's one of 2 non-Indians. And Sherwin is such a fine fellow that I just know that he'll really do a good job. Then Judge William Roy Rhodes is a tribal judge, and Matt Clapp is a Rincon Indian. Task Force 5, that was Indian education. Helen Sherbeck, she is a Lumbee, she is the chairperson. And Earl Barlow is a Blackfeet, and he is a superintendent of schools up in Browning, Montana. And Lorraine Busy Isaac, another Caldwell, who who's the third member. Task Force 6 is Indian Health. That's Dr. Everett Rhodes. He's a Kiowa, and he is a physician. Luana Reyes, Caldwell again. This is Caldwell, right? And I'm actually just putting these names in here to make the Caldwell for people. No, it really is. We have, I believe, three. Lily McGarvey is in Aleut. The Task Force 7, again, and I can tell you something about this one. Peter McDonald is the chairman. Ken Smith, Peter McDonald, of course, is the chairman of Navajo. Ken Smith is the business manager and the member of the tribe at Warm Springs, Oregon. And Philip Marsh is a member and former chairman of the Mississippi Choctaw. That particular task force right now is going to recommend some kind of special impact Indian Marshall Plan or Indian Economic Recovery Program for Indians. And to that, I didn't really coin the phrase. I just picked it up somewhere and started to use it because I thought that America, and I think we're going to have to be conscious of trying to get something over to people. America has got to understand that in its history, and I think to its credit, whether they want to say whether they were intimidated into it for whatever reason, in the history of the United States, to their credit, they have economically recovered their enemies in every war, in some cases, like, for instance, Germany, twice. Because it was everybody except one, and guess who that was? So what we're talking about now, it's never too late, and in 1976, now is as good a time as any is to have an Indian Economic Recovery Program, an Indian Reconstruction, an Indian Marshall Plan. And Task Force 7 is absolutely coming down with that, and there isn't any doubt about that. And we are talking about, and again, we're going to have a lot of help because we are proposing this as a special thrust program over and above, and as to what with the tight purse strings and all, the way I suggest we do that is we take a little bit out of the Defense Department's travel, which is really excessive. And many of the special thrust things that are needed in economic programs come in the form of guarantees and so on, like bonding and so on. And there are many ways. And one of these slants is to set up a kind of a TVA type of operation. The Task Force 8 is urban, rural, non-reservation Indians. It's Alfred Elgin is the chairman, and many people know him. He is very active in Indian affairs. Gail Thorpe, and I won't identify her as the daughter of Jim Thorpe, because she isn't like that, so I'll just say she's a great sort of sister, and Grace is the daughter of Jim Thorpe. And Ed Mouse from Oklahoma. Under Task Force 9, tremendously important one, Indian Law Revision, Consolidation, and Codification. And they're really doing good work. Pete Taylor, the only other non-Indian. There are 31 Indians and two non-Indians. The legislation calls for at least two Indians in each task force. And there were 31 Indians elected out of 33. And other members are Yvonne Knight, who is a Ponca from Oklahoma, and an attorney. And Browning Pipestem, who is also an attorney, who is a Oto Osage. And Task Force 10 is terminated and non-federally recognized Indians in an extremely controversial area, I might say. And I hope, my own personal hope, is that many times, you wouldn't think so, many times the right thing, the moral thing, the law, all tend to converge at one point. We have plenty of cause to think that doesn't happen, but occasionally it does, and I hope it does for these people. the Jojo Hunt is the chairwoman, she called herself. And she insisted on it, so I won't dispute her because she is about 6'4". A very lovely 6'4", I might say. She is an attorney. And John Stevens is a Posmaquoddy. Many of you may know him. John argues with the commission. Robert Bajarkas is a Klamath. And the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Task Force, Reuben Snake and George Hawkins. And Reuben we brought in for the spiritual aspects. He's a roadman for the Native American Church. And we thought we had to have a little bit of everything in that task force that would be appropriate to it, and that can be more effective than alcohol and drug abuse programs themselves. It takes so long to just explain, you know, about those people, and I could have shortened it up quite a bit by not telling you who all the people were and leave a list, but I feel those people are important enough that we should say who they are. And I have a limited supply of these. I'll send more, and it explains the legislation. It's called Public Law 93580. And it will not be just another report, because we will all